In the preface of your new book, you say that Donald Trump's election to President of the United States was what gave you the impulse to write about fear. Before, you had written about anger and retribution in your latest book, and you say that you had been missing something there. What was that? What did you overlook?
Okay, well, first of all, it wasn't just the election, but the fact that I learned about it when I was far away from all my friends and I had nothing I could do but think. And moreover, I was in a place, namely the Kyoto, Japan, where I was supposed to be very happy and I was supposed to be expressing appropriate gratitude for the award they were giving me. So it was that set of circumstances that made me really want to dig in and analyze my own fear. Where was it coming from? What did it mean? And, you know, so I was thinking about the fear of many other people in America, both of what might happen if Trump assumed the presidency, but also, on the other side, the fear that had brought Trump to power. So I was thinking about a lot of different people's fear, but I also felt that I was part of the problem because I noticed that my own fear was not balanced or even-handed. Now, the other thing to say is that it wasn't just a book on anger that I'd written before, but I'd written books that analyzed several other emotions one by one. So in a book called Upheavals of Thought, I analyzed compassion and love. I had separate sections for each of those. In my book in 2004, I analyzed the emotion of disgust. So I had been kind of marching through the emotions one by one, and I hadn't really asked, is there something that links them all together? And I think really the link is in the condition of extreme vulnerability that human beings live their whole lives in. But the response to that in the primary way is fear, that fear is both developmentally the earliest emotion and it's evolutionarily the most primitive. It's shared by all vertebrates and lots of invertebrates. So it's an emotion that can be appropriate in situations where what we care about rationally is threatened, but it also has a particular primitive quality and a propensity to run ahead of itself and lead us into trouble. So I noticed that about my own fear, and then I thought, well, really, it underlies lots of other emotions. It helps to explain why anger turns politically toxic. It's a kind of fear-driven anger that we need to watch out for especially. I thought it also is closely linked to the emotion of disgust because disgust is focused on our animality and mortality, and it's a way of repudiating people and things that we take to be signs of our mortality. And then there's envy, which I think is very closely linked to fear. So in short, the project of the book, as it took shape in my head as I stayed awake in Japan, was to look at fear, but then look at the other emotions through the lens of fear and see how an inappropriate and non-deliberated fear is what renders them politically problematic.
We will talk about those three other emotions later, but let us stay for the moment with fear on a personal and individual level. Your book is entitled The Monarchy of Fear, and we could say the king in this monarchy is what Sigmund Freud called His Majesty the Baby. Talk to me a little bit about this connection there.
I think that fear is connected to monarchy in two different directions. The first is that when we're frightened, we turn to an all-powerful caretaker for comfort. And this is one thing, of course, that babies have to do because they can't move. Human beings are unique in the animal kingdom for being physically powerless for a very long period of time, and yet cognitively quite aware of what's happening to them. So if they want to get fed or comforted, babies have to rely on powerful others. And that is a factor that keeps cropping up in human life and leading us to want to run for consolation and comfort to some all-powerful leader. The second is what you just said. The baby, therefore, becomes a kind of monarch, because they have no way of joining forces with others in a democratic solidarity. But the only thing they can do is to order people around by crying and making a lot of noise. And so they become little tiny monarchs. And that, too, is a great danger for democracy. Rousseau talked a lot about this, and I talk about him in that part of my book.
So fear is something which we experience when we are little infants, but it seems to stay with us. Why don't we grow out of this? Because, I mean, we learn to communicate and that there are other ways to get what we want. Why don't we grow out of fear?
Well, I think to a certain extent, if we have a good upbringing, and I mean just a relatively stable one, we do, in that I turn to Donald Winnicott in the book, who talks about the facilitating environment that a good family will provide. So if children get used to being fed, then they don't have to be terrified that they're not going to be fed. But the problem is that vulnerability continues and even grows when we realize that we're going to die. And that means that we are powerless with respect to the most important thing of all. So I think, you know, that it's the fear of death that it explains why democracy is difficult. My point in the book is that both in the family and later in the community, we can become capable of trust and reciprocity, mutuality, but that trust is always threatened underneath by fear, which is springs up in many circumstances. It's not just about death. It's also fear of physical pain or betrayal by others and so forth. But I think it's because if we care about the world, and I do believe that it's right to care about other people and about our own health and things. I'm not a stoic. I don't think we should withdraw our concern from the world. But then we see, if we're rational, that we don't control all kinds of important things, such as our health, the well-being and health of the people we love, the fact that we live in a good political community. We can't control that. And so then fear rears its ugly head and propels us often into action that's unwise.
But can't fear also be a positive thing? I mean, you mentioned, for example, the human fear of snakes, which is a mechanism evolution has obviously programmed into our brains as a warning system. So fear is not necessary. Is it not necessary in certain situations to save our lives?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so I'm not entirely against fear. The Stoics and even Gandhi thought that we should eliminate fear completely because they thought that it was actually not right. It wasn't rational to care about our bodies, our health, and all the things that can go wrong. We should just live in the world as it is, and if something bad happens, we should just accept it. So I don't believe that. I think it's right and rational to care about our health, our freedom from pain, about people and things that we love, about our country, too, when it's threatened by something bad. So there are many good occasions for fear, but the problem is that the particular psychological nature of fear is that it dashes ahead, and it's because of its sort of evolutionarily primitive quality, and because it bears the memory of early infantile experience. For those two reasons, it's not easy to hold it in check and to say, "Now wait till we've analyzed the pros and cons." And of course, as democratic citizens, that is what we should be doing. We should be looking at history. We should be saying, how bad is this threat compared to the way things were in the 1950s? But people don't do that. They don't look at history. They don't compare one thing with another. And so they get into a state of panic, and they just think, oh, everything is terrible. They start having apocalyptic thoughts, which I fear are often encouraged by religious texts. And they think, oh, now we're sliding down into the abyss, and how can we be saved? So that is not very helpful. So what we need to do is not to eliminate fear completely, but it is to separate the potentially helpful kind of fear that motivates us to do something good, to defend what we care about, from the kind that is just not very useful.
I would like to start with a recent example of fear in a political argument, the 16-year-old Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg. I don't know if you have listened to her speech at the World Economic Forum at Davos. It was in the international press.
Teaching over in Kyrgyzstan, so I didn't listen to anything. Yeah.
What she said in that speech to the world leaders there was, I want you to panic because of the climate crisis. What I want is I want you to act like your house is on fire, because our house is on fire. Aren't there situations where the lack of fear can also be a danger?
Yes, I certainly agree with that. I think in the book I give a number of examples of how politicians, for example, who want people to evacuate when a hurricane is moving along the coast, they do have to whip up fear. And that's something that should be done, I think, rarely and only in circumstances of great urgency. But sure, there are times when one needs to do that. The problem is that a fear that's whipped up in that way is not easy to target a useful action. It's not easy to control. So I think it's fine for the climate activists to say that, but then they need to follow it up with good, rational proposals for what we can actually do, and with arguments showing exactly why their proposals are the ones that we should adopt. And sometimes they do that, and sometimes not.
Fear is the most basic emotion, you say, but the real danger arises because fear leads to other strong and negative emotions, anger, envy, and disgust. How do they relate to fear?
Okay, well, anger has its own internal problems. I think that the part of anger has two parts. The idea that something wrong has taken place and it would be good for that to be addressed, that's in principle fine. It's good to recognize when wrong has taken place, and it's good to address it and protest it if we haven't yet figured out how to address it. But the other part of anger that says, oh, those people should be penalized, they should suffer for what they've done, what I call the payback part of anger, that part often is fruitless. It looks at the past rather than what we can do in the future. And so it's what I call for in that chapter is what I call protest without payback. That is, we'll say, here's something wrong that's taken place. Now, how are we going to deal with that going forward? How are we going to stop that from happening? And payback desires usually don't help that. The idea of, well, let's destroy all those people can take over and make it actually much harder to solve the real problem. I use the example of Martin Luther King Jr., who said that the anger of people who came to the civil rights movement had to be purified and channelized, meaning that they have to let go of their retributive desire, their desire to just destroy all white people, but they have to then turn to the future with hope and with constructive work and use their protest to make things better. So that's my basic idea. Now, how fear works is that when we're feeling helpless, we really lash out and we find scapegoats. We want to hold somebody accountable, whether there's anyone to be blamed or not. And then we try to inflict punishment on that bad person. And I think we learn this very, very early. Our earliest fairy tales as children have that structure. So there's a real problem that's difficult to solve. Let's say Hansel and Gretel, they go out into the woods to look for food. Well, there in the story, the problem is hunger and the fact that their parents have to work at very menial jobs and therefore they're not there to take care of the children. But the story tells us that those very real problems, which are hard to solve, are unreal. And the real problem is a witch who lives in the woods who turns little children into gingerbread. And so this is what do often in the political life. There's a difficult problem, let us say the problem of immigration, which is a very, very difficult problem all over the world. And instead of figuring out, well, exactly what kind of problem is it, how many new migrants should we admit, and how can we think about the dangers that we think might be posed by too much migration, people don't stop to deliberate at all, but instead they find some scapegoat. Like in a lot of the political rhetoric on the American right, there's an infestation. There's this horde of people coming in. And then the symbolic gesture of creating a wall is used to just punish those people who may well actually be needed as laborers. In fact, a lot of the American economy depends on having more immigration. Farms in particular are very upset by this curb on immigration because they do need more workers. And furthermore, the wall tells us that we're keeping out something that's really, really bad. And it makes us feel a kind of bogus sense of safety, like we've actually achieved something. So all this scapegoating is very dangerous, and it can lead and does lead to hate crimes based on race, based on religion, and so on. And, of course, we've seen recently in New Zealand how horrible that rhetoric of fear can be. The murderer in New Zealand was somebody who felt fear that the white race was being replaced by hordes of brown and black people coming in. And he acted out in the most horrible and disgraceful way, killing a lot of innocent people. So that's the kind of thing that I think can be the dividend, the bad dividend of a fear-powered anger. Now,
let me jump into at this moment, because I think we are already talking about disgust.
Yeah, we are.
This is certainly the most visceral of these three emotions you are dealing with. Often, disgust seems to play a crucial role in political discourse, especially on the right. Anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, racism, xenophobia, they all use disgust to stigmatize people they go against. And this seems to be the most bad of those three. I mean, I can be angry at another human, I can envy another human, but disgust, doesn't it basically dehumanize a political opponent?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. Now, disgust, you say it's visceral, but actually the psychologists who do work on it have found that it does have an ideational content. It is the idea that this is something connected to our animality and mortality, and that it must be distanced from ourselves. So it's even in the simple form, what I would call the primary object disgust, where it's our own feces, our waste products of many kinds, our blood, and so on, even there, there's something quite irrational about it. Because what we're saying is these substances, which are part of ourselves, we want to distance them and say, oh, we're above all that. We want to be pure and far away from those contaminating products. So then the problem is then it escalates from there and people start projecting those disgust properties, bad smell, animality, hypersexuality, onto minority groups that they then treat to bad subordinating and, as you say, dehumanizing treatment. And so, yeah, in every society, there is that phenomenon of what I would call projective disgust. It's always different groups. We've actually had a very interesting collaborative project with our center in Delhi, where Indian scholars and American scholars are comparing the different varieties of their disgust formations. We have this book called The Empire of Disgust, where we compare American racism with the Indian caste hierarchy and so on and so on. So there are many different different groups that get targeted for disgust, but it's always bad. And as you say, it always has the message, you're a mere animal and we can't treat you as an equal. So I do feel that it's very, very pernicious in the political life. And you know, there are, in common law countries, there's this legacy of thinking, so-called, that disgust is a good reason to make something illegal, even if it causes no harm to others. There was a very distinguished British law lord named Lord Devlin, who wrote about the proposed decriminalization of homosexuality. He said, well, this is something that disgusts people, and people must be allowed to use their strong feelings of disgust in order to make something illegal and keep it that way. Why? Because otherwise the solidarity that's needed to bring society together to fight a war would be lost. He was writing this right after the Second World War, and he said, we wouldn't have been able to win the war unless we had laws against homosexuality. So fortunately, that view did not prevail. It was countered very effectively by the great, and now we know, closeted gay legal thinker Herbert Hart. And so there was a fine debate that I always love to teach. But anyway, I mean, that's just one example of the way that disgust has not just a feature of social life, but it's actually infused the culture of law, which I think is even worse, because, you know, it's bad enough to have bad people doing bad things. But then to be told this is okay, this is legitimate, and it's a legitimate source of law, that's far worse.
Now, let us look at ways to overcome fear. You say, in short, it is hope that is the key. That may sound rather vague at first. What kind of emotion is hope?
Well, it's a puzzle, isn't it? Because it sounds like something very different from fear. And yet, as in fact the Greek Stoics always like to emphasize, it's actually very similar to fear, because both involve the thought that something that's very important to you hangs in the hands of chance. So when you fear, you think there's something bad that might happen and you can't control it. In hope, you think something good might happen and you can't control it. But of course, they're very close, because the very same event might trigger both. If your parent is ill in the hospital, you might think with fear of all the bad things that can happen, but the very same situation might give rise to hope if you focus on the good things. So hope is different as a perspective, as a kind of focus, but the essential content of its fixation on uncertainty is the same. So the question is then, why should we shift from fear to hope? Hope energizes constructive action. If we hope for the parents' recovery, we are going to do things that we wouldn't do if we just despaired. We will probably get a second medical opinion. We will go visit the person. We'll try to encourage them, and so on. And the same is true in the political life. If we allow fear to take charge of us, we'll run away and we'll think, oh, this problem can't be fixed. But if we have hope, we will be energized to take positive steps, working for a political candidate, doing whatever is in our power, writing something, in my case, to make things better. And so, actually, Immanuel Kant thought that we had a moral obligation to cultivate hope in ourselves, because we have a moral obligation to do good in the world, but we're not going to do good in the world if we don't have any hope. And I think that was entirely right. There's nothing can tell us whether there's a reason for hope as opposed to a reason for fear. But all we can do is to do that. I mean, try to encourage in ourselves habits of hope that will energize ourselves in the direction of good, constructive action. And that's very personal. So I think for each person, there are different things that are what I call practices of hope. But some of them would include the arts, which I think are great schools of self-understanding and therefore of hope, because I don't think you can have hope rationally founded without self-understanding. I think that working for a political cause or joining a protest movement is a practice of hope. I also think that for many, many people, and this is certainly true in my city, religion is a very important practice of hope. If you think about the African-American community in Chicago, how do they get to have a constructive and positive approach to the future? Well, very often it is because of the black churches, which have really understood very, very well how people in bad circumstances can become more hopeful and what they can do if they are hopeful. So a lot of the protests are led by the churches and so on. So there are other things. I think that education of the sort that I call liberal arts education in universities is a practice of hope because it gets people to listen to each other, to analyze, to step back, to ask for the argument rather than jumping at each other's throats. So I think that's very important for young people to have that at some point in their lives. And then finally, one of the suggestions I make at the very end of the book is a program of national service, because it's very hard to have hope that's focused on anything real when you don't know anything about the other people in your country. And in my country, we're de facto segregated by class and by race. And so I do believe that something that's like the Zivildienst that used to be part of the German National Service should be required for all young Americans, something like 2 years where they'll go and do service in a different part of the country, maybe doing elder care, child care. There's a lot of work that is there to be done because we don't get that work done by any kind of national health insurance program, unfortunately. So doing work that needs to be done, but in the process getting to know the country and its people, which is something that people used to do through military service, but boy, they don't do that now, of course. And I think it's better done anyway through a kind of civil service. Now, of course, that can be done other ways, too. A lot of businesses and law firms and so on require people to do some kind of voluntary service as part of their job. But I think when people are just graduating from university, when they have a lot of projects for the future, that's the time when it would be very good for them to learn something about the different groups that their society is made up of.
That was already kind of a big arc you opened up there. Let me get back for just a second to this fear and hope being two sides of the same coin. They have similarities, but they have also fundamental differences. And to me, it seems that fear seems to throw me back upon myself and seems to isolate me, whereas hope, as you talked about it, connects me to other people. Would you say that this is the main difference?
Main difference is in the whole cluster of action tendencies that the two are associated with. And so in the case of fear, the tendency is to run away from the problem rather than to address it. In hope, the tendency is to try to figure out some constructive way of addressing the problem. But you're absolutely right that one aspect of that is that in the case of fear, you focus only on yourself. Let me get out of here. And you don't think so much of what's happening to other people. Fear is a very isolating emotion. I talk about soldiers' narratives where people talk about how in the heat of battle, can't think of anything else but their own body. You know? Because, of course, when you're threatened that way, the world shrinks to a little point that is you. In the case of hope, yes, absolutely. I mean, one obvious thing to do in order to constructively address a problem is to make common cause with others. And you are certainly very, very likely to do that.
You also say that hope, wishing for the good to happen, does not suffice. It has to be transformed into political action. And let me go back to Greta Thunberg again, the 16-year-old Swedish climate activist, in her argument for fear, for panic. She went against hope because she says it seems to her that it leads to passivity, to always say we hope for young people, there is so much hope. Doesn't she have a point there? Can't be hope also something which blurs our view?
Well, I think, you know, look, both have to be for things that are rightly analyzed. And obviously, everyone has hope for the success of their projects, and sometimes their projects are bad. So when we have something worthy, like grappling with climate change, and we figured out that that is important and it is worthy, then is it better to address that through fear or through hope? I think that's the question to be asked. Well, you know, I think fear is paralyzing. I think that people often just wring their hands and they think, oh, there's nothing to be done. Whereas hope, first of all, as to go back to your earlier remark, it connects us to other people. So not just thinking about ourselves, but about our children and our grandchildren and our whole community, we think, well, what do I do for them? And what can I do? And I think anyone who feeds fear, up to a point, I think it's okay to at least alert people to the problem through fear. But then you've got to give them something hopeful to do. Otherwise, they're just going to retreat into their shell and think, oh, well, it's après moi le déluge, you know, nothing to be done. Let me just live my life however I want. And if you think that it doesn't make a difference, then of course you'll just burn carbon and you'll go flying on many, many jet planes. And so you won't try to deal with your own activities. But more important, because I think the level that has to be addressed is the political level, you won't work to get anything done politically. Why should you? You might as well just live pleasantly until you die. So I think she's maybe right in a short moment where we need to arrest people's attention, but then after that, we really, really need hope.
There is one thing we have not yet discussed, and that is the role of fantasy and of cultural imagination. It seems to play a big role in the construction of the images of what we fear. Is it also, would you say, the key for hope, for envisioning that what we hope for?
Oh, I think all the emotions have a strong role for imagination, and that this imagination is usually mediated by culture. That's one of the things that makes it so slippery and so tricky, because a lot of cultural images are bad, racist images. So with disgust, I think there's almost nothing good to be there. Well, there is nothing good to be said about it. I don't think it's so harmful when we're disgusted by some spoiled milk, because that at least is connected to something real. But, you know, with disgust towards persons, I think there's no good in it. In the case of fear and hope, I think the imagination can play both good and bad role. So with fear, obviously, when we fear the hordes of immigrants, I think we're not doing things well. We're not stopping for information or analysis. But there are times when, as we said, fear alerts us to an important problem. So it's all in the details. With hope, too, okay, our fantasy needs to be mediated by something that's connected to something practical. So here, I think Martin Luther King Jr. is such a wonderful example, because he was not... He seemed to be a utopian thinker in that he drew on prophetic images of a dream and so on. But if you look very carefully at what he says, and I point this out in the book, everything is stuff that could be realized in a short number of decades. And in fact, most of the concrete things he dreams of have actually been realized. Like, I have a dream that one day down in Alabama, little black boys and little black girls will be able to join hands together with little white boys and little white girls as sisters and brothers. Now, you know, everything is not perfect in Alabama, but that is a daily reality. Schools are really integrated, and kids are going to school together, but they're also intermarrying. And I even held up the press just as my book was going to press to point out that a candidate for the Senate who had been supported by the African-American population defeated a very racist candidate, and showing that Alabama has changed. I think that's something King would have been amazed by. But anyway, the point is, he directed hope toward the possible. even though it sounded like a dream. If you direct it towards something unrealizable, then when that isn't realized, then you're going to have despair and anger and, you know, the kind of stigmatizing and scapegoating that I have repudiated.
Martha Nussbaum, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Bye.